Before we get started, I'm just going to do a brief introduction of Michael, our participant on tonight's chat. Michael's been a director, writer, producer with over 40 years of experience in film and TV.
And I'm tired.
His credits are so long, I had to do a little cheat sheet here because there's so many of them. So amongst many credits, the Good Lord Bird, Hell on Wheels, Stargirl, Van Helsing, Battlestar Galactica, The Flash, The Purge, Defiance, Black Sails,
and that was just last month.
All right, without further ado, we'll start our chat, and I'll just give you a heads up. We'll try to focus this a bit more on career development and whatnot. We'll touch a bit on craft, but the idea is that we can take advantage of Michael's expertise to sort of teach us a bit of the ways to successful directing and producing career.
Cool.
Thank you.
Well, let's see if you're applauding when this is over. So, first bit of advice is avoid these chairs as much as possible. These are the worst. They'll kill your back.
Do you want a different chair?
No. I'm good for now. But I kind of 15 hours on the set.
Yeah.
Like this will destroy you. Apple box, much better.
Michael, why don't you briefly tell us a little bit about your story and how you got started?
Oh, my God. You know, looking at it from this viewpoint, I didn't realize at the time, but when I was 10 years old and my grandfather placed an 8mm movie camera in my hand, that was when it started, because I don't think I've ever put it down. As a matter of fact, that camera's in my office right now. It's still there, and just to remind me, keep me on track and humble. I had this crazy introduction to the business. I grew up without any connection to it, even though I grew up in Los Angeles. And here's the short version, because I know that we don't have a lot of time, but I made a very, very ambitious student film when I was 20 years old, and the right person saw it completely accidentally and was, I didn't know him, he came to a screening. And he was the head of animation at Disney Studios during a time where they were kind of lost. It was before Eisner went in, and it was being run by Ron Miller, who was Disney's son-in-law, and the studio was kind of drifting. And they saw the movie, and they called my partner and me in and said, we think you can do something that we haven't been able to do, which is to reach the teenage audience. So what do you say we give you offices and you come up with movie ideas for us? And so at 22, like a couple of months out of college, I had an office at Disney. And that's how I started. So like that's not going to do anyone else any good. I had no strategy. I wasn't smart. I just made the right movie, and the right person saw it on the right day in the right frame of mind and showed it to someone else, you know. And that's how I got in. And, you know, and then what I learned is that, you know, when you're starting out, you expect that, oh, yeah, once I make it, my career trajectory will be this graph that goes like this. It doesn't. It goes like this.
And what led you to, as I understand, your most recent career has been a lot of TV. Is that correct?
A lot, yes.
And how did that transition work?
I made a movie at Disney, so I was a writer-director at Disney for a while, and that just sort of like bottomed out. I had a lot of aborted attempts to revive my directing career, which was all I was interested in ever. I never had ambitions as a writer, it just seemed part of the process to me. But I couldn't get that second feature going, and so I started writing. I couldn't get anyone to hire me to direct their movie. So I thought, I got to write a movie. So I started writing movies and was good enough at that so that I had a nice little career as a feature writer. And I was making money, and I was optioning stuff, and I was getting paid as a script doctor. But I wasn't getting any closer to back into my directing career. And one day, a director who I'd become friends with, who had directed a movie I did a big rewrite on, which is a movie called Ruskies, starring Joaquin Phoenix when he was that big. Anyway, he called me after a while and said, I just did a pilot for a show, and why don't you come and see the pilot and maybe pitch, you know, ideas, you know, for the show. And my reaction at that time, in my youthful arrogance and having only worked in features, was like, oh, your little television show? Yes, well, I think I'll, yes, I'm not busy that day. I'll, you know. Anyway, so I saw this show. It was a show in the late 80s called Life Goes On, about a family with a Down syndrome teenage son. And I thought, oh my God, this pilot made me cry. And these guys, and I read some of their scripts, and I thought, these guys know more about writing than I do, and I can learn from them. And so I said, yeah, what do you want me to do? So I pitched some stories. They bought one. I went on the writing staff, and then just for a year wrote scripts that they liked, which I put, that's which is under the category of luck, and told them every day, of course you know I'm a director. And then these two wonderful showrunners, after my sitting there for a year waiting for my Ruby Keeler moment, went to battle for me with the network and ABC and Warner Brothers, and fought for me and got me my first episode. And, you know, and I was ready for it. I was so ready for this thing. And I also, it was an episode I wrote.
Oh, nice.
So I was like a writer, director in television, and that did very well. And so, like, I was back on the horse. And so then, I just, like, fell in love with TV because... Well, here was my writer moment, falling in love with TV. We were doing a show. That show was very much about things. It was about, you know, Down syndrome. It was about being an outsider. We did a 2-year arc with the first HIV positive character in television. We did, and so then we were doing a show about homelessness. We're touching on homelessness, and the producers came in. They said, and it was an episode I wrote, and they said, we need one more scene. We're short. And we have to shoot it tomorrow and write it. And so I wrote this scene. I just sat down and I thought, like, well, what do I really have to say? Like, what's the, you know, what can I say about homelessness that will resonate with people and make and be positive and make a difference in the world in some way? And so I wrote this scene that I just poured my heart and soul into. The next day there were actors shooting, you know, acting it, and they were shooting it. And 4 days later it was on television and 12 million people saw it. And I thought, wow, wait a minute, this is pretty great. And also I fell in love with the amount of work that I was required to do in episodic TV. You know, it's just I was writing every day, and then when I was directing, I was just like, it was just like one after another, and I got onto this role, and I felt like I'll never, like I've directed like over 100 hours of finished film, television. That's like, that's 50 features. You can't cram 50 features into a lifetime. Unless you're like John Ford, then you get twice as many. But I just fell in love with the amount of work I got to do. So I guess a long answer to your question.
So you got that first chance you've been waiting for, you've been writing. How was your preparation in terms of like, okay, this is an opportunity, I've been waiting for this, I've been asking for this opportunity, I've been writing. You're on set or you're in prep. How do you make sure that you make the most out of that opportunity, you think?
Well, I was annoying. You know, I firmly believe that the world, you know, can give you what you want if you just say it enough times. Not to yourself. Not to yourself. You say it to everyone who can possibly help you over and over and over again. You know, what is it? The great triumvirate, like mind, word, deed. Thought, word, action, or whatever. Anyway, I'm firmly, you know, and I really just, I got that. When I was in elementary school, they taught us this thing called the fire triangle. They were teaching us about fire safety. And the three sides of the fire triangle were heat, oxygen, and fuel, right? And if you take any one of those away, you have no fire. So there's a movie career triangle. And it's skill, perseverance, and luck. You take any one of those three away, you have no career. But you need all three. You need, like, if you don't persevere, it's not going to happen. If you don't have the skill, finally, when someone says, all right, shut up already, you know, direct something, if you don't have the skill, you can't deliver, and then it's all over. And if you don't have luck, that's not going to happen either. So, you know, there's two that you control and one you don't.
That's the trifecta.
Yeah.
A successful TV career.
It's worked for me.
And how was it when you got directing again? You're in TV world, but you started in a show that you're writing for. You knew the showrunner. How was it like when you go to a different show where you haven't worked with people again, and now you have to collaborate with actors, the cinematographer, the showrunner? How do you prepare, and do you have a take on that, or you just take it as it comes with each and every show?
It's interesting. It's, you know, every time you take a job, it's marrying without dating. So you have no idea. You have no idea what's going to come. And even if you think you do, you have no idea. And as a gun for hire in episodic, I'm always walking into a situation where I usually know nobody. Or I know a few people, and I have to be a very quick study about the politics, mm-hmm. where the power center is, who's angry at who, who's frightened, you know, what does each actor need from me? I mean, there's a whole, like, you know, very, very fast education that you have to provide yourself when you step onto a show, and I love that. I do really dig that. It's a really great challenge. You walk into a, you know, a party where you hardly know anybody, and everyone looks to you and says, "What do you want to do?" And you know, but you know, my experiences over the years have been, you know, from shut up and do the shots we want you to do, the way we want you to do it, to make your own movie and let us know when you're done, and everything in between. Although I have to say that it's mostly on this side. I've almost never had do these shots and this is how we do it. Almost never.
Even in TV?
Especially in TV. That's like it's kind of a misconception. People think it's like, oh, they've got their show and it's got to be like this. Well, yeah, because they're writing all the scripts and they've already cast it. So you've already narrowed the range. But within that range, I found that if it's a brand new show, if you're in season one, nobody knows anything. So usually they say, well, like, help us find the show. and if they've been going for a few years, they usually feel like we're so bored with ourselves, bring us something new.
And how do you find that fine line? I mean, you're an episodic director. You're hired to do a show you haven't worked before, and there's always that fine line where you're trying to – how do you calibrate imprinting your mark, whether it's – do you think that that's in terms of style, or do you think, you know, my imprint is just going to be my personality and the way I'm going to lead this day and this ship to the finish line versus continuity of style? Do you ever think about it? Is it something that just comes organically with your work?
I'm so not interested in my style, you know, because I don't, I mean, I look back on and people who know me say, oh yeah, I kind of thought you directed that because, you know, you bring your taste to it, but I'm always thinking about what the audience needs. I don't like, I'm so, like, over myself. And I also teach directing when I have a chance, which I enjoy immensely. But director's vision is a vastly misunderstood and misused idea. I'm going to steal a line from Spielberg, who said, I'm not a great director, I'm a great audience. You know, because you walk on a set, and you have five pages, and you have three actors, and you have a set, and, you know, the camera can go anywhere, and they can walk anywhere, and they can say it in a million different ways. There's so many different ways to do it. It's paralyzing. Until you figure out, like, okay, what does the audience need from this scene? They've just seen that scene. They're expecting this. What do they need from this? And then all of a sudden, you've narrowed your choices because you're serving the audience. The director's the first audience. So, which leads me to two ideas. One is that your ego is your enemy on the set or in your career. It'll destroy you every time. And when it's all about you, it's going to stink. When it's all about the audience, it's going to be great. And the way you understand, the way you know, recognize your ego is that anytime you're angry, it's your ego. It's like, he shouldn't. I'm the director. How could he talk to me that way? And the other is, I just lost my train of thought. Because I got to laugh.
I'll stop that.
The other is, I'm quoting other directors, and this quote I can't quite remember who said this, but some director said, he goes, I get to the set and everyone has something in their hands. He goes, the DP has a camera, and the grips have lights, and the electricians have lights, the grips have stands, and the script supervisor has a script, and he says, I have nothing in my hand. So he goes, so I guess my job is to help everyone do their job.
That's very interesting.
And so I find that if I look at directing as a service job, if I'm there to help everyone be their best, if I can help the DP make the best shots he's ever made, you know, and help the actors give the best performance they've ever given, like, that's my style.
Yeah. Do you...
And going back to your question, is that that's never in conflict with the show.
Which is the way to get hired back.
Yeah.
With your experience now over the years, because, you know, when you started, I remember when I got my, which is very recent, by the way, when I got my very first shot at directing, and I talked to a few directors that had just gotten their first opportunity, and it's preparation and, you know, prepare, but... don't over prepare. And after going through it, I think what they meant by it is that don't prepare yourself, over prepare and shot list it to a degree that if something goes different on the day of, an actor doesn't want to move a certain way, or the sun has moved a certain way and that direction doesn't work, that you have the flexibility and the understanding of the scene and the story that you can make it work a day of. Now that you've been working on TV for many, many years, has it changed the way you prepare to an episode? Do you like to do very detailed shot lists and whatnot, or with your experience, do you have a sense of the scene day of, and then you make decisions?
No, my prep has, I believe like fix it and prep, and you cannot prep too much. What experience has given me is confidence to deal with when it goes sideways. And so I rarely shot list anymore because I trust myself to understand to see what's happening in front of me and understand where the audience needs to be to witness it. But like I prep rigorously. This is my wife Liz sitting back here, which is the real reason I have a career. But she'll tell you, like, when I'm in prep, she doesn't see me on weekends. I'm on the set. I'm imagining it 500 different ways. I'm walking the set and like, oh, I think this, like, the set looks best from this side. And maybe they'll do this. And, oh, here's a little trick called seating the set. You know about this one?
No.
Okay, so you go early. Oh, here's the other thing. I always show up an hour before call. Because I front load the day's work and just get it in my head so I don't have to look at the script and my notes. I've got it. And it's a quiet time as everyone's filtering in. I can just like sit and think and question all the decisions I made in prep. It's like, oh, now I'm here today and maybe it could be different. Maybe I have a new idea. But with blocking, I'll have an idea of like where I want the flow of the, you know, the actors to go. And so I'll move the furniture around so that it's obvious where to go. Mm-hmm. I'll create a path over to the window or something. And so, because an actor will never move the furniture for some reason. So I go and just push the furniture around. And then I get there and I said, so where do you think you want to go?
Big signs.
Yeah. And there's this path. They go, oh, I think I'll just go there. But then they own it and everyone's happy. So to answer your question, prep rigorously and I throw it away. Because the act of prep is not to have that storyboard that you mm-hmm. follow, or the shot list, or to block it the way I thought. You know, back when I didn't have the actors in front of me, I thought it should be blocked this way. Well, that was a decision made without all the information. Now you're there on the day. Now you have all the information for the first time. See how they feel that day, what the weather is, what they're wearing. It's like, okay, now I got the whole thing. So, and you were driving towards this. It's like you never want to be blinded by mm-hmm. your prep to see what's actually in front of you. So I'm happiest when it all goes south. You know, because then I get to create in the moment. It's like, okay, the crane didn't show up. All right, let's do it this way. Let's do this. And like, more often than not, it's better. More often than not, it's better. But having gone through the process of prep, having gone through the props and the shots and the lighting and the, like, every department meeting and all the times that you think about it, having gone through that process, now you understand the scene. And you understand the mm-hmm. spine of the scene and what's important. And then you know all the things that really aren't important that could change. And then once you've got that core in place, it's like, you know, Pilates, right? You get your core. You get your core strong. Then, like, yeah, you're good to go because, you know, whatever happens, like, you know when you need to sort of, like, you know, nip at the strays and get the pack hurting in the right way. And when you can, like, oh, my God, show me something new. This is fantastic. But you can only be that way if you've prepped it to death.
So you're comfortable knowing what the story is and yeah. what needs to be told. And do you know Steve Allison? He's a director.
Yeah.
So Steve, who's a great friend, he just came to direct an episode of Riverdale. He was telling me a bit about shot lists. And
is Brendan still on it?
Brendan's in New York doing Katie King, but he was with us for two seasons. And Steve said, well, anybody can write a shot list because I can go close up on so-and-so, master, two
They all
shot,
look the same.
Right? They all look the same. Look the and same. He said to me, it's
specialty
all,
shot. That's
it, yeah, he said, it's all about staging. If you understand how to stage a scene in terms of the blocking, then you know how to photograph. And you don't want to be putting people into multiple directions in a room and causing all sorts of problems and split eye lines and whatnot. So, especially early in your career, for those of us that are starting or trying to get a break, is there any obstacles or clear mistakes that you made in terms of, I should have been blocked this way. Oh, you know, in hindsight, don't do this. Any do's and don'ts or things that you learned that were pretty obvious to you?
Everything. Okay, so I thought I was in trouble psychologically until I read in Billy Wilder's autobiography that he did the same thing, and then I knew it was okay. But I get in the car at the end of every day and go, fuck, shit, oh, God, now I know what that scene is. Oh, why didn't I get, oh, God damn it. Where's that wine? Every day. As a matter of fact, I brought some clips. I don't know if we'll get to them, but the reason I brought the clips is because there's only, like, that tiny bit of my own work that I can bear to look at. And this was from an episode that I was kind of proud of, and so I brought some clips. But even in, like, sending the Vimeo links to Ryan for tonight, I was looking at it going, oh, shit, I should have, you know. So it never ends. Someone said, like, movies are never finished, they're just abandoned.
And that's what the piece say about lighting when they've been holding back for 2 hours. That's their line, too.
Yeah, just like, okay, all right.
Okay, fine.
Where no play goes up because it's ready, it goes up because it's 8 o'clock. did I answer your question?
Can you think of one? I mean, just in terms of some, do you have anything anecdotal about, you know, geez, you know, how to navigate through your politics? I mean, what I'm trying to look for is that whether that first chance, whether when you go outside of your family, people you worked before,
my biggest regrets are the times I wasn't kind mm-hmm. and patient. Those are my biggest regrets. I've almost never lost it. There was one time I said something that I was very proud of at the time because, you know, usually you think of the clever thing to say on the way home. But actually, like, for the like one time, I thought of the clever thing to say in the moment, mm-hmm. and I instantly regretted it and was made to pay for it for, like, in a week. So I was doing a show years ago with William Devane, who is not the most patient man. And we're doing this big party scene where, you know, it's like 25 people in this big room about the size of this room and setting up the first shots. And the 80s had called him too early and he was like getting antsy and, you know, I wasn't even going to shoot this fucking thing. And it was like one of those days. And the AD said, oh, Bill, so we're almost ready. We just, like, we're having a problem with the monitor. And he looked at me and he said, Frank Capra never needed a monitor. And I said, yeah, but he had Jimmy Stewart.
Ooh. Oh! Wow.
And William Devane made me pay for that every second of the rest of the show. And I just, like, as soon as it came out of my mouth, I wanted to, like, oh. Yeah.
I didn't mean that way.
Yeah. So I've been very careful. I go home and write them down. Burn the paper.
Since that took us to a story related to working with actors, you know, there's this, I think, that's my opinion, that there's this misconception when you go work on TV shows that the actors don't want to be directed because they know the characters and they've been there every day and whatnot. How do you approach that? Are you pretty immersive with your notes to actors? How do you approach that from a TV episode?
It's interesting because I've almost never encountered that. Most actors, like, love, you know, real direction.
I agree.
Most actors love real direction because they're out there every day. Like, yeah, they've done their homework and they know their character, but acting is a dangerous, difficult thing, and they're exposed, and, you know, they're doing something that I cannot do, and I have so much respect for their ability to do what they do. And so, you know, I'm always just trying to crack open doors for them. There's a great quote from David Lean. He said, I see what the actors bring, and then I tickle them. I find usually, like, I was doing this, God, what was it? It was some kind of, like, spy, CIA. It was the Agency, a show called The Agency, and we did this, like, Daniel Pearl thing where they had... It wasn't a writer, it was a politician who had been captured by some terrorists and tortured, and they put a video camera in his face and had him read this, you know, thing saying, you know, the United States was evil. And so as direction, so I went up to the actor before we rolled on this videotape, and I said, keep in the front of your mind that your daughter will see this videotape. And he looked at me. I said, you're giving me a weird look. Did I confuse you? He goes, no. He goes, I've done 5 episodes here, and you're the first director who said anything to me.
It's very true. It's very true.
I just did a show with Ethan Hawke. I did the finale for this miniseries called The Good Lord Bird, which I am actually very proud of. It was a really great, really great experience. And it was also a show where they were like, bring your shit, come on, like, just bring it, we want it. And the producer, before I started, saying, you know, Ethan, the first 3 directors were afraid to talk to Ethan, and he really wants direction. But I don't need to be told that. I love talking about acting. It's like, it's the best part of it. How do you get the scene to work? How do you create this, like, thing, this magic thing in the air between 2 people? It's like,
I can agree with you more, and I think that was one of the... It's sort of a myth that circulates when, like, oh, no, you know, they know what they're doing, they know their character, and the way I like to approach is that, I said this, I feel like when the episode is airing, there are a million of people watching, there's a big audience, but the day of, there's an audience of 1, and that's the director, and they're acting for you. And if you're not a good audience, even if it's to reinforce something that it's good in what they're doing, or allowing them to experiment, then they're really not performing to anybody, and then they feel they need to self-direct. And I think that's when they shut down. And over the years, if they're not getting any good direction or no direction at all, they become less open to direction whatsoever. And
if you're watching yourself, how do you live in the moment? How do you let go? And I'm all over. Although here's my target whenever I'm giving a note to an actor. So I saw this interview years ago with Terrence Stamp, and he was talking about this movie he did, his first movie called The Collector. It was a William Wyler picture, and the story is that he's this, like, young, like, sociopath who has no one in his life, and the only way he thinks he can get a girl to love him is to kidnap her and tie her up in the basement. Very, I don't think he'd make that movie today. But he's this disturbed guy. And so Wyler sets up this close-up of Terrence, and the close-up is designed to be the shot that leads us into a flashback. And the flashback is about when he worked in the post office and everyone was cruel to him. So just before they roll, and this is Terrence telling the story in his interview, Wyler goes up to him and whispers in his ear, "The taste of the stamps." And that's the best direction I've ever heard. So I'm always going like, okay, how do I get it? Five words or less, mm-hmm. a single idea, and something to do with the five senses.
Wow. And I think that's all meant to... If you focus on something as simple as that, you're in the moment. And you're listening to whoever you're acting against. And I think it's all about being in the moment. In any direction they can allow themselves not to be thinking about anything other than just whether it's business or listening in. Mm. It's very effective.
Yeah, it's also the directing, like giving an actor a list, forget, terrible idea. You know, it's like, okay, in this take, you know, I need to be a little bit more angry. But then when you get to this part, it's like you're kind of forgiving. And then it's like, oh, and watch that word that you're mispronouncing. And then like, oh, and then can you like stand over there like when you tie all the phone? You know, it's like
the emotional.
The actor's like, the actor's going like, okay, well, I gotta like get dinner when I go home. So you know, and also like one idea changes a whole scene, especially if it's an idea at the beginning of the scene. It's the way you come in. It's like, you know, you do a scene and you go to the actor and go like, this time come in as like you just got a parking ticket. That's a different scene than like you just got a raise. So actually, I find that I direct towards the moment before the scene starts a lot.
It's interesting. Yeah. Give them a little intention just as they start.
Yeah.
DPs in TV.
Yeah.
You know, How do you approach their relationship? Are you pretty hands-on with shot lenses, how you want it to look? Is it truly a collaboration in your mind, or in the episodic world, do you take a little step back, let them set the shots, and you just sort of adjust them as you see fit?
No, I love monkeying with the shots. I love creating the shots. It's like if you don't love this whole job, it's too hard. It's just too much work. So if you're not like getting your thrill with every part of it, picking wardrobe and, you know, scheduling and putting out fires and helping people, you know, it's like if you don't love all that, it's like it's many easier ways to like make a living. But no, I don't make a shot list, but when you've got a groove going with a DP, and it's really all about, you know, an episodic, often you don't have, you know, there's shows that either have one DP and you have 5 minutes with them before you start. There's shows that have two DPs, and you have them in prep with you the whole time. And you know, I'm super like I know every lens, I know photography, I know that shit. So I try to help the DP understand that I'm really excited about this stuff, and I have lots of ideas, and I want to hear all of their ideas, and I want to have a give and take, and I'm not going to like cram anything down their throats, and like let's have a tennis match and just throw stuff back and forth. And so, you know, I'll block with the actors a couple of times and we'll start getting something into shape in a scene. And then, you know, before we bring the crew in, you know, I'll watch it with the DP. I'll have the actors do it once with the DP and I on either side of the room having a silent conversation. And a good DP will not stand next to you. A good DP will stand on the other side of the room, and while the actors are going in, where you're going, like, he's going, no. And it's always because it's toward the window. But but it's like you want that. It's like, because you can't stand on both sides of the room. And so if you have a good DP is watching how it lines up from that side or from over there or from under the desk or, you know, and you're doing the same thing, and then best idea wins.
Did you ever have to work with... I mean, that sounds like a perfect collaborative scenario. Did you ever encounter a DP that was resistant to your ideas and you had to navigate that to survive that particular show or episode? And any tips on how to deal with that in your mind?
Well, that's, you know, you will run into contrary people, you know. an actor lashing out and a DP who's dug his heels in or her heels in, and you know UPM just does this all day. I mean, it's like, you know, there's a million, you know, ways you can run into people who are not going to help you. And the overall, the sort of the macro response I have to that question is that all misbehavior is based on fear. I've never seen an exception. Mm-hmm. So rather than going head to head or dealing with the symptom that's presenting itself to you, you stop and take a step back and you're like, what's this person afraid of? They're afraid it's not going to look good. They're afraid they're not going to get home in time. They're afraid mm-hmm. that, oh, you know, there's a kind of a hard-ass production manager. When I'm not around, he's given the DP a lot of grief about schedule. It's like, this happened on the last episode. Like, once you, I usually try to dig out the fear mm-hmm. and then allay it. And then everything just kind of opens up. So it takes a bit of a psychological, you have to care and you have to like do the work and you try to figure out like, okay, why am I bumping heads with this person? What's going on? And you have to do it fast.
It's a crash course, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's so much fun. I love it. It's like,
well, it's not for the faint of heart, is it?
No, it's actually a drug addiction.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Because you have the adrenaline of the mm-hmm. terror of the job, the absolute terror that you're going to fuck up and that you're not going to make your schedule and it's not going to be good. And, you know, it's like that's pumping adrenaline into your system 24/7. And then you have the endorphin high of the creative act. And it's like, oh, God, it was close up. I wasn't even going to do a close up. But look at the way the light's hitting. Oh, my God, oh, she cried. And, you know. And that cocktail of those two chemicals, man, it's like you can't like ever not have it.
I like to joke. I mean, I never played sports in nowhere near professional level, but I compared to like, you know, is that adrenaline, that rush of like quarterbacking Super Bowl or playing something at a really high level and intensity, then like, I just want to do it again. I just want to conquer that thing part creatively, but also part that I just conquer that day or getting the troops yeah. around and you leading them to victory. Is there something about it that
oh
is
oh my God, there's nothing like it. There's nothing. I mean, the scariest moment for me is walking to the set in the morning and seeing all the trucks. Like, oh my God, there's like 5 40-footers full of equipment. This is costing someone an enormous amount of money and nothing's going to happen until I say something. Oh my God, that's the worst moment. And but every once in a while you walk away victorious and you know, it's great.
And that just that brings a good point because that's also something that I hear a lot from experienced directors. It's like, it's all about making the decision. It may be the wrong decision, but you have to, like, you don't have time. You just make a decision, commit to it, make the best of that decision because mm-hmm. they're waiting for you. You're the first general with a sword and that horse, and if you point in that direction, the troops will follow you. But if you're like, oh, I'm going to go over here, I'm going to go over there, yeah. then I'm just like, eh, I'm not sure I'm going to go with this guy. I'm gonna just drag my knuckles and stay back. So, yeah.
On Good Lord Bird, I guess they had the director that preceded me was problematic in some ways, and they had a couple of directors without a lot of experience. And so when I came on to do the finale at the end, I made sure that my first shot was something fairly simple. It was a whole scene, but it was really, I was shooting this master from across a field, so like a house was that big, and I was really just needed the ride in and then sort of the geography. And so like I nailed that one down. I walked on. I was like, okay, it's call time. I said, okay, let's go here. Let's see the guy ride. Okay, good. Let's put the camera here. I'm ready. Let's go. We're not lighting. Let's shoot it. And we did it once, and I said, okay, good. Next. And everyone went, oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that got me through the whole thing. It was that first, like, 20 minutes.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
You just got to come in, and yeah. you got to win them that first.
And, of course, that night I thought, would I... to have him right, should you come on the other side?
Yeah, yeah. But you made a decision, though, right? Because yeah. they snip fear on me. Like,
oh, yeah. Yeah.
Editing, TV, this day and age, you know, you see a lot of directors there booked all year round and overlapping shooting days and prep and whatnot. A lot of people editing remotely.
So beautiful when that happens.
Do you editing remotely? Do you like to be in the editing room? And what do you think? How do you approach making it? What do you look for in your director, Scott? How do you like to deliver your episode to the showrunner? Are you conscious about running time? Do you lift scenes? Do you lift dialogue? Is there anything as far as your approach to editing and TV and delivering that content?
You know, being in the room is 100 times better than remotely, because you can't, like, you know, it's like, wait, did you, was there a take where he did that? Oh, yeah, yeah, just try that piece. Oh, no, I'm wrong. Put it back the way you had it. Like, you can't do that remotely. You have to, like, do this, and then the response time is a day, and it's really, really a weak way to edit remotely. Sometimes you have to do it. But also, it's like, editing remotely for me is, like, I have to recognize the change I want to make, and then I have to write it out in a way that the editor is going to understand it. Mm-hmm. Right? So that's the whole other layer of, it's another like 3 hours of work for, you know, each act, just to write it out in the right way and send it to them. And so being in the room is great. I always like to approach it, or it's like, I'm going to cut it the way I think it should be. But I always talk to the executive producer first and tell them that's what I'm going to do. Mm-hmm. And 99% of the time they go, great, show us something new. And 1% of the time they go, give me, like, don't cut any scenes out. Let me see everything. Okay, all right. Because I'll hack this. You know, I shoot long, and I look for the moments between the dialogue, and I look for everything I can possibly extract from a scene, and I shoot tons and tons and tons of footage. When I go into the editing room, I'm a 12-year-old with ADD. Like, next, come on, throw that out. You have to, as an editor, you have to hate the director. Like, you have to abandon all the emotions that you had on the set, and like, oh God, it took us 6 hours to set up this shot. Who cares? Like, once again, you have to be the audience. Story. Forget your pretty shots. Unless they, you know, the audience needs them. So I go like that, you know, and I cut to time on my cut, and mm-hmm. you know, I make it mine. I totally make it mine. And what's behind it is not like mine, it's not ego, it's maybe I can show them something they haven't thought of. Because mm-hmm. I know the EP can go back to the editor's assembly like that mm-hmm. and cut it however they want. So I'm like, you know, let me show you what I think it should be. And then I, like, after I handed my director's cut, done, next. I learned early on, like,
you don't look at their cut?
No. I don't watch it on air. No. Rarely is it better.
I agree. But
rarely
but
is it better.
But, I mean, I tell you, I watch it because, the main reason why I watch it is because, yeah. Well, the show I'm working on currently, it usually runs very long. And it's very packed. And one of the main reasons that I watch the producer's cut, and, you know, I usually watch my hand is closing the, you know, and then if a shot stayed in or something, and I get transferred, like, yes! And then I go, And if there's more, you know, punching the air than you know, biting my knuckles, then it's a win. But the reason
you're,
I watch
it... You're stronger than I am.
Yeah, the reason I watch it, though, is because if I'm going back to that show... After watching two or three times, okay, I'm not gonna waste my. I'm not gonna die on this sword, because knowing this show, this is how it's probably gonna cut. So I feel that I can gear my energy towards what I think is an educated guess of what's gonna make that cut or not. That's the reason I watch it.
There's this idea, and it comes in. It's in the editing room a lot, but it's all through. You get this from the network, from the producers. You know, where you're always encountering someone who's telling you what someone else is going to think. The editor's saying, oh, the showrunner hates stuff. Like, he doesn't mm-hmm. like seeing the color yellow, or, you know, mm-hmm. like, whatever. Mm-hmm. And, or the network hates it when you blah, blah, blah. And I always take that with a grain of salt, because a savvy person will use that power it has nothing to do with what the network wants, it's what they want. But if they say, oh, the network loves it this way, then what can you say? So I'm always trying to suss out, like, what am I actually hearing? And I get, and it always happens in the editing room. So you have to understand, you know, as a guest director here, this is a big thing. You know, everyone you're dealing with is on the show for the whole season. You're the guest. They all want to keep their jobs. So you know there's a certain amount of their loyalty to the show, and there's a certain amount of loyalty to you during your director's cut. You get your cut, and you know your AD works for the producer, but he also works for you. And so on a show by show basis, you have to determine, like, is this an assistant director or an assistant producer mm-hmm. that I'm working with? And you know, and so you're always sort of trying to find out where the boundaries are. And, you know, how much, you know, when, like you said, when you're wasting your time. Mm-hmm. But also, I'm very skeptical of people who tell me what other people are going to think. Like, if someone says, look, I hate this. This is like, you know, we did it in the last show. It doesn't work. Actually, the surest way to get a director to change his mind is that, yeah, the last director did that.
Did that, yeah. Yeah. Well, or the best way to make him do something is like, well, we're never done it. This way. Okay, this is the way we're doing
yeah.
it. Right? Okay, great. You never sat there? Fantastic.
Yeah.
You're sitting there. And I agree. And, I experience that, too, a lot of times in, you know, oh, you're going to do French overs? Oh, Roberto hates French overs. You're going to do a handheld? They don't like handheld. And I'm with you. I think a lot of times somebody may have used that storytelling tool in a way that it didn't work, but that doesn't mean that person doesn't like handheld.
Yeah,
they don't like long lenses. Because then you just, creatively, you just handcuffing yourself and like, okay.
Yeah,
and
the person telling
down.
You had a problem
yeah.
with the showrunner or something, but I always just call. He goes like, so are you, like, I'm thinking about doing French overs. Are you good with that? You know? And they'll either say, oh, fuck, I hate them. Or, I don't know, what's a French over?
or you present it in a way that, you know, you think they're going to like it.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes, because I find sometimes, too, that you're trying to explain something over the phone, and then I'm going to do this, and they're like, I don't see it. Just do it the way we've been doing. Sometimes, like, okay, I'm going to present something. I have a way out.
Yeah.
I have a way out. If they don't like it, I got this and I got that.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's like if you cover, if you give them yours and theirs,
but I find sometimes the sales pitch, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. Either you oversell it and then it's like, oh, I was imagining something, you know, that was going to blow my mind, or they don't understand. It's like, you know what? I'd rather you just do a close-up and then be done with it. Do you watch if you go into a new show, do you go and watch episodes to get sort of, do you study the style and whatnot?
That's basically how I watch television. I just watch 10 hours of Another Life because I'm going to do two episodes of Another Life. So I just watched 10 hours of season one and started reading scripts leading up to mine. So yeah, that's where, see, I don't go look at my stuff, but I'm a, you know, diligent student of what they've done before.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mike.
Oh, your pleasure.